Hello and welcome to The World This Week with me, Gavin Lee, live in Paris, every week discussing the biggest stories of the past 7 days with my panel of distinguished correspondents. Our programme now selected as one of the best 100 podcasts around the world for current affairs. So thank you for watching. It's been a week where the world said goodbye to Pope Francis. Tens of thousands of mourners queued to pay their respects as he lay in state in St. Peter's Basilica over 3 days of mourning. We'll discuss his life and legacy, the geopolitics of his papal funeral, and look towards the conclave that will follow.
I had seen the Pope when we came with the Paris 2 years ago and met him. It was an unforgettable moment. When he died, I felt a pang in my heart because the Pope was part of my heart.
I will never forget him for the rest of my life.
It's been a week where Russian forces launched the heaviest assault on Ukraine's capital since last summer. 70 missiles, 145 drones hit a civilian district in Kyiv in a week that began with a sudden announcement from the Kremlin of a 30-hour Easter truce. See this peace posturing propaganda by European leaders. President Trump claimed he has his own private deadline in mind before he will walk away from efforts for a real truce, making a personal appeal to Putin. Vladimir, stop, he typed on social media, writing he's not happy with Russian strikes. Although in person, no such narrative.
I think we have a deal with Russia. We have to get a deal with Zelensky. And I hope that Zelensky, I thought it might be easier to deal with Zelensky. So far, it's been harder, but that's okay.
It's been a week of renewed tensions between India and Pakistan after the deadliest attack on civilians in Indian-administered Kashmir for 25 years. Militants posing as police shot and killed 25 Indian tourists and one Nepalese citizen in a Himalayan mountain retreat. Kashmir, which is claimed both by India and Pakistan in its entirety, has been a flashpoint for insurgency for decades, but attacks on tourists are rare.
India will identify, track and punish every terrorist and their backer.
A distinguished panelist joining us on tonight's programme from Rome, France 24's Italy correspondent Seema Gupta. Seema, great to see you. Thank you for joining us. You probably barely had a night's sleep in this momentous week of covering the Pope. And if we go back to what we thought were the big events of the weekend, his meeting with J.D. Vance, meeting the crowds after delivering his Easter message on Sunday. Little did we know at the time those would be the last public images of him. And 24 hours later, you breaking the news on his death of France 24 and non-stop reporting in the last 3 days of lying in state. How are you? And what's it been like to cover?
I think it's been intense. Intense because I followed this papacy right from the start when he came out on that balcony at St. Peter's and announced and said to everyone in a very simple way, brothers and sisters, buonasera. That was his greeting. Good evening. It really set the tone for his papacy, if you like. Someone humble, someone who just wanted to speak to the people the way that he could, to reach out to them and then to cover it through 13 years on a papal trip as well. And then finally, of course, to have the news of his death. An emotional moment personally, but also in terms of just the coverage, the outpouring of sadness and also remembrance of his life.
We're going to talk about the life, the legacy, the conclave to come. Great to have you with us tonight, Seema. We're also joined from Ukraine by Svetlana Moronets, Ukrainian journalist, staff writer for The Spectator, awarded the coveted Young Journalist of the Year at the UK Press Awards 2024, honouring her outstanding journalism. The judges pointed to Svetlana's clear-eyed work, insider perspective, allowing her to uncover angles often missed by seasoned correspondents. Svetlana, welcome to the programme and congratulations on your recognition.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. You've said your work has cost you tears, nerves, countless sleepless nights, which is also a powerful message, I think, isn't it, to the many out there who scroll the socials, they take out any old misinformation. Quality information is scarce for a reason. It is much harder to mine, and that is why good, trusted journalism matters more than ever, doesn't it?
Yes, of course. And as a Ukrainian, I feel it is the least what I can do for my country is to tell the truth. And then the readers will decide for themselves if they want to support Ukraine or not.
It's fantastic to have you with us, Svetlana. Svetlana also runs a Spectator newsletter, Ukraine in focus. Now, here with us in the studio, Victor Mallet, senior editor for the Financial Times. Great to have you with us, Victor, who has spent three decades reporting from Asia, Europe, the Middle East, Africa, author of two critically acclaimed books, The Trouble with Tigers, The Rise and Fall of Southeast Asia, and River of Life, River of Death, The Ganges and India's Future. Victor, interesting this week, because you must have taken an interest, I think, in the US Veep's trip to India and J.D. Vance's diplomatic footprint there. What have you made of that?
Yes, and also, of course, the terror attack in Kashmir, which had a big impact and is threatening to cause another war between India and Pakistan over water. Actually, you were mentioning rivers, and there's another possibility of a war that will involve the waters of a major river. So, yeah.
It is very interesting, given that both sides, I'm going to talk about Kashmir in a moment, and the risk towards a war between India and Pakistan. India pointed the fingers at Pakistan being behind it, Pakistan denying it, but they've switched off, they're threatening to switch off the major rivers into Pakistan. Pakistan saying this is a declaration of war. On to more peaceful matters, just briefly, before we look at that. Let's have a look at an image you're familiar with. You've been there several times. This is our man in the US, J.D. Vance, at the Taj Mahal this week with the family. Let's take a look at this image.
Hey, Mary, can you put your hands down? It's okay. Can you just look ahead?
It's okay. Come here. I can't even open my eyes.
You can. I know, buddy. It's hard. Just do it for a few seconds. All right, one, two, three.
One, two.
Minded to ask you, is that usual to see the Taj Mahal so empty? So beautifully lit.
I don't know whether they kind of cleared it for him or whether he was there a particular time of day. Yes, I mean, it is pretty hard to get that picture, but you find that VIPs are able to get it. The curious thing to me was to wonder whether he kind of is aware or wants to publicize the fact that it was essentially a Muslim monument or from a Muslim king, you know, who built it for his loved one. So that's a, you know.
It is a shiny shot to go up on the family album, I am sure. But I think it is the fact that there is an image of that. It looks beautifully posed. But just to see the reality, telling the children to be quiet. We all know what that's like if you've got children.
India is not as, is more crowded than that in real life, definitely. Yes.
Victor, a pleasure to have you amongst us tonight. Let's also bring in another great friend of the programme, Elizabeth Pino, Paris correspondent for Reuters. Elizabeth covers the Élysée Palace, Matignon, the seats of French presidential and prime ministerial power, and author of several books, including Le Vestiaire des Politiques, the brilliantly titled The Politician's Wardrobe. Elizabeth, an evening. I want to mention this particular book because you've looked at the clothes politicians use to shape their public image, the meticulous planning that actually goes on behind the scenes.
Yes, well, it's a very important matter. The first thing people see when a politician enters a room is what are they wearing? What about their hair and their clothes? That's the thing I noticed first, and that gave me the idea of the book. And then I'm also very interested in fashion, and indeed, it's still the case. When you watch Donald Trump, when you watch the King of England, when you watch Emmanuel Macron, you say, what is he wearing today? What is Brigitte Macron wearing today? The colour, his face. So that led us also to talk about many things, like the Made in France thing, the protocol, the sexism also. That's everything goes with the many things are said with the costume.
Yeah, this is not just apropos of nothing. There is a team behind it, and I'm minded say this week President Macron is on this Indian Ocean tour. We'll talk about what you think he did and didn't achieve shortly, but I would like to know whether there's like a clothing change for Team Macron for a hotter climate, or is it just whatever, unflinching, unchanging sartorial look for the president?
Well, the president may leave the jacket when he goes in islands like that, but he keeps the tie and the white shirt. And all eyes are on Brigitte. She was with him, and she's the one that people want to see what she's wearing. She's normally wearing Louis Vuitton clothes. It's a French mark, and all eyes on her normally. She's used to that, but it's a bit heavy for her. And in those state visits like that, all eyes are on them, and of course clothes are very important. But they And the suit for the president is definitely a white shirt and a tie.
It's kind of circa, I've noticed a picture of the Indian Ocean, kind of circa Tony Blair in the 90s, you know, jacket behind the shirt rolled up. I'm getting to work, but it's a bit hotter temperature than as Europeans are used to. And yet, it's hard to see them venture beyond that. I think there's a couple of times we see President Macron in a hoodie, but that is usually like after an election period. They're quite rare, aren't they?
It's a communication. When did ask that? We had hoodie, but it was for TikTok, for youngsters, for, you know, for the social media. When he's officially, he never wears a hoodie. But when he wants to talk to the youngsters or to say, well, I'm cool, or he had also a hoodie from the army. So it was a message for the militaries.
I'm with you, Elizabeth. It's a delight to have you with us tonight. Let's begin. Easter Monday, 9:45 in the morning from the Apostolic Palace, Vatican City. News came of the death of Pope Francis. News that after many years of poor health, recent months of critical illness seemed likely, and yet, after being seen in public talking to the crowd in St. Peter's Square less than 24 hours before, where he seemed to be recovering, well, it did come to many as a shock. Cardinal Kevin Farrell broke the news.
Carissimi fratelli e sorelle, con profondo dolore devo annunciare.
Dear brothers and sisters, it is with profound sadness I must announce the death of our Holy Father Francis. At 7:35 this morning, the Bishop of Rome, Francis, returned to the heart of the Father.
Roma, Francesco, è tornato alla casa del Padre.
We'll go straight to Seema in Rome. Seema, reportedly, the Pope's last words to his personal nurse, Massimiliano Strapetti, were "thank you for bringing me back to the square," referring to his time in the crowd at St. Peter's and in the Popemobile just the day before. And given he went out to meet the crowd on Easter Sunday, despite doctors advising convalescence for 2 months, perhaps the way he wanted things to go.
Absolutely. I think that really is the message that is behind this Pope, one of service, very much on top of the agenda for him, being close to the faithful, expressing the fact that he wants to be there for them. He was about compassion. He was about unity. Those are some of the messages that he tried to bring across. And if you think about it, he really was a first in many ways when he became the pontiff. He was the first non-European one for a long, long time, the first Latin American, the first Jesuit, and the first one to pick the name Francis after St. Francis of Assisi, someone who really looked at the fact that there was life and in every human being, every element of life in the world, whether plant or whether animal. So really about protecting the environment as well. So all these things came in as first. And he did, in his own way, frustrate the traditionalists within the church, especially, let's not forget that famous line, "Who am I to judge?" when he talked about gay people and marginalized people and how he supported them and helped for justice for the poor as well.
He was born Jorge Mario Bergoglio in Buenos Aires in 1936. He turned to the church in his early 20s, rose to the ranks of Jesuit leader, was elected Pope in 2013. Seema, as you said, you were there. He was a compromise candidate, wasn't he, in the conclave that could appeal to both conservatives, to progressives as well, and wanted to bring the faith forward, be more inclusive. Some of those issues you mentioned, like who am I to judge? 12 years on, Seema, how do you think he'll be remembered? What are the words that people you've talked to this week have been saying?
I think a lot of the people I've spoken to talk about his humility. They talk about him being really humble. The fact that he chose, even the way his funeral is going to be carried out, the fact that the coffin is a simple wooden coffin with a zinc casing. It's not what previous popes had, where they have three different layers in terms of the encasing. And he also wanted a pedestal that was lower. And he's chosen not to be buried in the grandeur of St. Peter's Basilica, but instead choosing another papal basilica of Rome. There are four, but one that is perhaps closer to his heart, because there was an icon of Mary there that was very important to him. He often went to that basilica before and after every single papal trip, and even after he was released from hospital. And it's just on a side aisle, and it's a simple tomb that we understand will be set aside for him in marble, marble from his family region of Liguria, because of course he has Italian roots, and it will have the simple inscription on top, Franciscus, which is his name in Latin. So really, all these simple elements led to many referring to the fact that he's humble, and they felt they could be close to him, that he was like one of them.
You talk about the simplicity. The story is about his simplicity in dress, that he didn't even want to wear white trousers with a white cassock, so he didn't want to look like an ice cream seller. So he had also his sense of humour as well. He said, as you get older, if you lose your sense of humour, you become sour victor. Listening to Seema, one thing that strikes me, when one is chosen as Pope, there is a formality that Seema will have covered last time, a Latin phrase that's put to the chosen one. And the Latin phrase you have to reply to it to accept the position is this, acceptor. I accept. Simple as that. When Pope Francis accepted, he said this, I am a sinner, trusting in the patience and acceptance of God, I accept. And I think that tells us a lot, doesn't it? This acknowledgement, and perhaps some say, that his papacy was about his own atonement and perhaps the guilt he felt for his time in Argentina too.
Yeah, I think what one takes away is just his tolerance. You know, liberals sort of criticise him for not having changed doctrine enough, you know, not having done enough sort of hard reforms, if you like, to church doctrine. But actually, his message was quite consistently, for example, sympathetic to migrants, informal or formal migrants. You know, during the Gaza war, he was calling, I think, a church in or Christians in Gaza every day. I mean, he really had that sense of somebody who cared for ordinary people who were suffering. And you know, this is totally out of tune, obviously, with the current political atmosphere in a place like the United States. Which is why, you know, it's kind of, I suppose, remarkable in a way that J.D. Vance, I think, was the last person or one of the last people to have an audience with him.
It is very interesting. Much has been said on social media about that, and people have kind of taken it away, and all sorts of memes as well. Elizabeth, what have you made of the Pope's stance on a world stage, and in particular when it comes to, you know, Victor was talking about putting the periphery to the centre, the lives of migrants and the poor, and kind of against the rhetoric of many world leaders and populists.
Yes, and it was symbolic that he refused to come to Notre Dame for the reopening, for instance. That he refused the pomp, and he preferred to go to Corsica, to Marseille, in very, you know, multicultural areas, in a small island. And that's very symbolic of what Francesco was. And there was a great deal of emotion in France, even at the Élysée. Emmanuel Macron with his wife are in Rome tonight, and he shortened his tour in the Indian Ocean to come back to Europe to be at the Pope's funerals. He met the Pope several times. And the Pope were rather tough with him, saying that he has to care for the migrant, to care for the poor, first thing, before anything else. And Emmanuel Macron tried to use him in a little bit with the Notre Dame drama, but the Pope refused that. That's very him.
And the very official line, which was the star of Notre Dame is the cathedral herself.
Yes.
You can't really get out of that one, can you, and say but. That's kind of full stop there. Svetlana, listening to this, we're hearing the news today that ahead of the funeral, amongst the kings, the queens, prime ministers, presidents that will be there, President Zelensky may not. He said, quote, there may be military matters. What are you reading into that?
Honestly, it's hard to say. Maybe Zelensky decided he needs more time to prepare for talks with Donald Trump. As we know, the last ones didn't go so well. And maybe he's just working on his counter-offer for peace deal that was presented to Kit Kellogg in London recently. Or maybe he's just busy. As you've seen, Russia has been attacking Ukrainian cities in the last 2 weeks quite heavily. There were a lot of civilian casualties, and maybe he has important things to do and to ask for, look for more air defenses, for example. So I don't know really what's happening there.
One interesting aspect to all of this is the Pope's speaking out on world wars. I'm interested in President Zelensky's relationship with Pope Francis. In pure PR term, Svetlana? Did he have someone on his side there?
Honestly, the Pope Francis was quite a controversial figure in Ukraine because since the beginning of Russian full-scale invasion, he has been calling on Ukrainians to raise a white flag and talk to Russia to be brothers. And it was met in Ukraine quite not as good because Ukrainians didn't see enough commitment from him to support their cause, the fight for their independence. Of course, his intentions were pure for the peace in the world, but unfortunately, the conflict in Ukraine is much more complicated than that.
It's very interesting. As we're talking, Svetlana, I wanted to look at some images in the last few minutes, actually. This is President Macron inside St. Peter's Basilica. He arrived from his Indian Ocean tour, which we'll talk about in a moment. It's very interesting, Elizabeth, as we watch these pictures of Emmanuel Macron and Brigitte, that he's decided to be there tonight. Remind us again, you talked to us a little bit about Notre Dame, but the relationship between these two.
Yes, they met several times, almost every year. They had the long talks. Emmanuel Macron has a special relationship with God. He decided to be baptized when he was 12. He asked his parents to be baptized. And he doesn't say he's not a non-believer, he's an agnostic. That's what he says. And his wife goes to church. And Emmanuel Macron likes to speak about hope. Several times, he's just thinking God is in his life in some way, and that was a way. But I'm sure he talked about that with Pope Francis. So, and they decided to stay 2 days. They're sleeping in Rome tonight. But that shows that it's important. It's not just going tomorrow morning for 2 hours for the funerals. They stay two days there, so that's important. I think that Emmanuel Macron was hoping to have a little bit of a diplomacy moment. I think they tried, all the diplomats tried to organize something with Trump, Zelensky, Starmer, Macron, maybe Meloni, but it was not easy. Maybe it was not the right time, and it has to be useful. So I think when they realized that it wouldn't be that useful, maybe that's when Zelensky decided not to come.
I was going to say, if we put two and two together, that's perhaps what we can read through this, that the idea of having some kind of more important geopolitical bilateral, it didn't look, in your view, like that was likely to happen.
No, well, I think they tried to organize something, but I think they had no answer from the White House. We'll see tomorrow. Something may pop in. We'll see. The body language will be important, and maybe they will have little chats in, on St. Peter's Square. Of course, we'll have all eyes there, and we'll be very careful about every signal.
We will, given how unpredictable President Trump is.
Oh, yes.
Watchwords. Seema, the other point to talk about, we talked about the People's Pope, a sense of humour. He rallied against capitalist elites and populists. He championed the poor, migrants, prisoners, said the church should be less about judgment, more about mercy. And yet, one of the biggest challenges, child sex abuse in the church. He took a lot of criticism for at first, didn't he? Burying his head in the sand and then admitted later that he had a conversion moment of understanding, didn't he? Is he seen as having gone as far as you could go on that issue, or is there still a lot of controversy around him?
Well, I think for the supporters of the Pope, they feel that at least he took steps to try and deal with the sexual abuse at the hands of clergy, of children and adults, and that he tried to create an extensive revision of the laws. He also expressed that this is really our shame. I mean, that's a word that he actually used. So there were efforts made, but for the victims of child sexual abuse at the hands of the clergy, it was clearly not enough. There's a feeling that not enough is being done to not just deal with the abusers, but also those that the survivors say covered up those abuses for so many years. So there is frustration on the part of survivors around the world, even here in Italy, that the church hasn't done enough to deal with the issue in a broader sense. He himself, particularly on the issue of a Chilean bishop, at the time said that the victims were essentially slandering the bishop, and then he had to take the step back when the details of the evidence came out and he had to apologise for them. So in that sense, at least he took responsibility when he made the mistake, is what some might say. But for a lot of the survivors, the church still hasn't done enough.
Simba, we look towards the conclave now, don't we? In a couple of weeks' time, I think conversations, whispers will already be going on with cardinals from all over the world voting. All men under 80, that's the rule, expected to start very soon. Now, I want to mention something which brings us on to the intrigue that I'd like to hear from you, some of the skullduggery, if recent TV interpretations are to be believed. Let's go back to 1268 to 1271. This was the election of Gregory X. The story is the cardinals, they were locked in. They were reported to have their rations reduced to bread and water. They had their roof removed, the palazzo, to expose them to the elements, and basically to shock them into voting. So it sounds like a Netflix survival game. Tell us about some of the skullduggery, perhaps, that goes on. I believe that still is that rations issue, that's still potentially within the doctrine now. That could be brought in if it takes too long. Is that right?
If it takes too long, but generally for the moment, they're quite comfortable in the sense that the Casa Santa Marta residence, which is where Pope Francis lived throughout his papacy, was actually built, purposefully built, so that it could house the cardinals that come for the conclave. So that's where they will be staying. And they're already in Rome, and actually they're already meeting in the Vatican. There are congregations happening every morning. They've taken a pause now for the period of the funeral, and they will start again on Monday. And what we understand is that they're talking about the role of the church in the world, but we don't know a lot, and they have an oath of secrecy for everyone that is in attendance. But you're right, it's only those that are under the age of 80 that can actually take part in a conclave. Conclave meanings with a key, because they are locked away. They are not supposed to have access to their mobile phones. They're not supposed to have access to the internet, to the newspapers, to anything. And when they're in there, they're supposed to be praying and also discussing about who potentially could be the next pope. And then, of course, you've got two sets of votes during the day, and eventually they have to get that two-third majority before we can see that white smoke and that we have a new pontiff in place. So still, there is a ways to go. For the moment, after the funeral, there will be 9 days of masses as a period of mourning, even after the funeral of Pope Francis. And then, of course, the conclave begins. We still don't have a date, but it cannot be earlier than May 6th.
OK, so last two, if I'm right in saying, going back to 2013, 2005, took around 48 hours, as we were mentioning earlier. And it's also worth saying that it is one of the most bet-on events of the year, such as life. Bookies are making a fortune right now. So here on this programme today, any early guesses that all of you can have bragging rights next time you're on the programme and say, I told you so. Is it the Bishop of Kinshasa? Victor, do you have any front-runners?
No, but I sort of wonder whether it isn't time for an African pope, but that's very speculative and I have absolutely no idea whether he would be or not.
Elizabeth?
There is a French name, Jean-Marc Aveline, the Archbishop of Marseille. So he's going to be in the conclave, and it's a name we can hear. They also talk about an Italian pope. We'll see. I've talked to a few bishops this week, and many of them told me that after this pope that was very open and very close to the poor, and that there could be a back to tradition
conservative
profile. That's what most of them told me.
Well, there is the Roman saying, isn't there, after a fat pope, a thin one. And given that in terms of decrees of the past, we've had John Paul II and Benedict XVI, it was seen that the one that perhaps pushed the progressive barrier more was Pope Francis. So we'll see. Svetlana, do you have a thought on who could be pope that you can come back with bragging rights on this programme?
Honestly, I didn't know. I'm not so well aware of I don't know, but I just hope that it will be the one who will be promoting the just peace for Ukraine. And as we know, as the Trump administration is very religious, and I hope that he will have some influence over Trump's team.
Yeah, I think there is a Mykola Bishok is an Australia-based cardinal who'll be choosing. He is of Ukrainian descent. Sima, the final say on this to you, to which I will pick you up on this in a few weeks' time to see what happens. Who's your money on?
I'll be honest with you. I have to say this time round, as in every time, it really is too open. Even though Pope Francis actually put in place the bulk of the cardinals that will actually be voting in the conclave. And so, will things move in a pendulum? You've had a progressive. Will it go towards a conservative, a more conservative candidate? Or will they continue on his track? Here in Italy, many are saying it will be an Italian. Could it be Matteo Zuppi, who was the Pope's envoy to Ukraine? Could it be Pier Battista Pizzaballa, who is the Latin Patriarch of Jerusalem? Many say he's too young. There are many names out there, but what I can tell you for sure is what the saying that goes here in Rome. He who enters the conclave a pope generally leaves a cardinal.
Very interesting. Seema, thank you. I was talking to a senior member of the British clergy this week. He said it is only, quote, the whippersnappers that can vote, and that is the under 80s. Let's turn to events here. It was, in fact, 5 to 4 in the afternoon in Paris, Saturday, when the news wires from Reuters, AP, AFP and Russia's TASS news agency flashed breaking news from Moscow. A unilateral 30-hour ceasefire had apparently been declared. President Putin orchestrated Russian press to record a meeting with his military chief of staff, Valery Gerasov, in which the military general said his troops had retaken almost all of Kursk, taking back 99% of the Russian border territory that Ukraine had taken in a counteroffensive last year. This was Putin's response, simultaneously explaining to the general and to the cameras.
Based on humanitarian considerations, today, starting from 1800 to midnight Monday, the Russian side announces an Easter ceasefire. I order a stop to all military activities for this period. We assume that the Ukrainian side will follow our example.
Well, it sounded like a commitment to a ceasefire from Moscow. Didn't look or sound like a ceasefire in reality. Fewer air sirens went off in some of the big cities, but ground fighting continued. Ukraine accused Moscow of 2,000 violations. Russia accused Kyiv of 1,000 truce breaches. The reading of several European leaders was this, a Putin PR game, playing with people's lives. Destroying human lives was the accusation after the events in early hours of Thursday morning. Dozens of cities hit by drone and missile strikes on the deadliest attack in Kyiv since last summer. 49 cruise missiles, 11 ballistic and 145 drones hitting 5 civilian areas, at least 12 killed. It prompted a personal plea in characteristic capitals from President Trump. Vladimir, stop! Exclamation mark, he wrote. I'm not happy with Russian strikes on Kyiv. Not necessary, very bad timing. Critical, yes. But are these words to match the and fits the severity of the moment? Well, the US president later told reporters he set his own deadline on a peace deal, one that he isn't making public right now. Svetlana, to talks today, taking us to Moscow with Steve Witkoff, the Foreign Affairs Mr. Fix-It for the US right now. What are you making of those talks and Crimea, the issue of the territory coming up a lot?
If to talk about Crimea, Zelensky can't concede it because Ukrainian constitution forbids it. And if Zelensky were to sign the deal, ceding Crimea to Russia without making changes to constitution, he could have been tried in Ukraine for treason. So to do that, all the Ukrainian deputies would have to take a vote. And I give you 100% they wouldn't vote for that. Zelensky is making a counter offer to President Trump saying that for 3 years, Ukraine said that they won't cede a territory to Russia, but he understands that Crimea can't be retaken in a military way. So he's ready to accept that the front line will be frozen. But Ukraine is not going to recognize any of its territory as part of Russia. And here we see Donald Trump saying completely the opposite, that Crimea will stay with Russia. And unfortunately, in Ukraine, it is seen as Donald Trump is taking the easiest way to end this war, is just to give Russia, if not all of it wants, but at least most of what it wants, to force Ukraine into concessions, because it is easy, it is fast. So far, Trump has not put any pressure on Russia. He said that Russian concession is that they are not going to conquer all of Ukraine, but it is a lie. If Russia could conquer all of Ukraine, they would do it a lot of time ago. But in the last year, they captured only 0.6% of Ukraine, and it would take them decades, if not a century, to capture all of Ukraine. So it is really not a concession. Trump has all the tools to make a better deal for Ukraine. He could impose a secondary sanctions on the countries buying the Russian oil and gas, including the European Union, who's still doing that. He could provide more air defense system for Ukraine. He could provide ATACMS, and Ukraine could use them to destroy Russian oil infrastructure that Ukraine has been doing successfully for the last 2 years, and that proven to be the most effective sanctions against Russian war machine. But Trump is not doing any of that because he's simply not interested. He wants to end this war right now. And the only way he sees to do it is to force Ukraine to concede its territories without providing real security guarantees for Ukraine.
Elizabeth, listening to Svetlana, we are coming up to 100 days in office. And at the same time we're hearing for Trump, we're also hearing President Trump's secret deadline. What are you making of that?
Well, he said he would make peace in 48 hours. It's 100 days, so it's more difficult than what he thought. As far as France is concerned, Emmanuel Macron is still trying to persuade Donald Trump, that he has on the phone several times a week, that Putin is a liar. But what he said, he said the word this week. He said, well, he lied. He said he wants peace and he's bombing Ukraine. So it's just lied. Just realize that. So I think France is still hoping to have Donald Trump on his side, on the European side, and it's not easy. Europe is really afraid of being left alone in this matter, left alone with Russia and Ukraine without the US, but the fear.
When you talk to contacts, the Elysee, and to use the analogy of Donald Trump saying that Kyiv, in his view, has no cards on the table, do you think the Europeans and the French particularly believe that they have a few cards here when it comes to the peace talks, when it comes to Putin, the peacekeepers potentially, and also the SWIFT pay system that Russia wants to be part of, which is based in Brussels?
Well, they try to convince the US that they can help, that they have a deal, they can do something. But in reality, I mean, the US have got all the power, and the European defense is too much dependent still on the US to be part of this negotiations right now. It's going to take years for Europe to be independent as far as defense is concerned. So it's really a matter of concern these days in Europe, because they really don't know how to convince either Donald Trump or Putin to do something useful to end the war and include the European in it.
Victor, we had a plan put out or released, seen by Reuters this week, that seemed to suggest a freezing of the lines, that the US might acknowledge Russian sovereignty over Crimea, which is clearly Ukrainian, and as we heard from Svetlana, would be very much against that. What's your take on actually how much closer to peace we are this week?
I mean, following up from both Elizabeth and Svetlana, I don't think we should underestimate the sort of gravity of the threat to the international order from the American proposal. Mm. Basically, they're proposing to accept war, to legitimize war, and as a means of taking control of the territory of a sovereign state, a member of the United Nations. And this is quite extraordinary, you know. And as you mentioned, it leaves Europe in a very awkward position. So not only is this disastrous for Ukraine, which doesn't even get a... Of course, Ukraine could accept a sort of de facto freezing of the front lines if it had a security guarantee, which it has not yet got from the Americans, and they haven't even sort of promoted a European security guarantee promoted by the American side. So, but we're now in a position where, frankly, the whole post-war order is at risk. You know, you have the Europeans are wondering nervously whether, in fact, you know, it's all over, whether America is effectively, by doing this, is leaving the Western alliance, because it's certainly leaving behind the principles that underlie the Western alliance, which is, you know, territorial integrity against the threat of Russia and the Soviet Union, as it then was.
And meanwhile, since the start of February, we have four trips from Mr. Fixit on Foreign Affairs for the US, the Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. All the US have right now is those talks with Russia, is this portrait gifted to Trump by Putin. Well, I think let's just show the image of this picture. This is handed to Steve Witkoff to pass on. Yeah. If you look at the image now, this is the artist behind it who released this actual image this week. Better than a Nobel Peace Prize, Victor?
Oh, God. I mean, you know, it's just quite extraordinary. And the idea, as you're suggesting, with all these Witkoff meetings, of not including one of the parties to the conflict and the aggrieved party, furthermore, in the negotiations for a supposed peace, is again quite extraordinary. This is a very, very threatening moment. And of course, Trump is unpredictable, but I think the whole of the rest of the Western world is extremely nervous about what might happen next, not just Ukraine, which, of course, is the primary and first victim of all this, but you have the rest of the world is also wondering where on earth this leaves the whole sort of international structure of recognition of sovereign states and not being able to attack a neighbouring country and take it by force.
Talking about recognition of sovereign territory, I want to take your thought and Seema too on where we go next. A place described as the Switzerland of the Himalayas, a tourist resort in the Indian administered part of Kashmir, of forests, of pristine rivers, snowy mountains, an area packed with people holidaying. It was around 2:30 in the afternoon this week. On Tuesday, we first heard shots fired, reports of militants dressed as policemen targeting tourists, 26 people killed. In a region that's seen three decades of conflicts, but tourists rarely targeted. India's Prime Minister, quick to react, cutting short his trip to Saudi Arabia.
I say this unequivocally. Whoever has carried out this attack and those who devised it will be made to pay beyond their imagination.
Wednesday night, a raft of measures in place against Islamabad, a shutting of the main border crossing with Pakistan, the suspension of visa services for Pakistani nationals, military advisers to the Pakistan High Commission in Delhi declared persona non grata, ordered to leave, and the most contentious so far, the suspension of a treaty allowing for the sharing of river water between neighbours. The move described by Pakistan as an act of war, which in tit for tat, suspension of all trade with India and bilateral agreements too. So there is a drumbeat on Indian TV right now, a fervour towards war. That is what the repertoire seems to say, is India, Pakistan, the next conflict. Victor, I'd like your thoughts and Seema too.
Yes, I mean, it's very worrying. Ever since partition in 1947, India and Pakistan have been unable to, they've fought several wars and they've been unable to sort of consolidate a lasting peace between two countries which really have a lot in common. They used to be part of British India. They speak the same languages, and there's really no reason why they shouldn't have a normal relationship, but that has just not been possible. Kashmir is, of course, a particular flashpoint. But I think this business of the rivers is quite interesting as well, because it sort of shows how control of the upstream part of a river can be an existential threat for the downstream state. China is actually the country that controls most of the sources of the big rivers in Asia, including the Brahmaputra, which comes into the Ganges, and where the Ganges comes out into the Bay of Bengal and goes through Bangladesh and India. But you think of what happened with the Nile. There were extreme tensions over Ethiopia's building of a large dam on the upper reaches of the Nile, which was obviously an immediate threat to Sudan, or not an immediate threat, but a threat to Sudan and Egypt downstream. So all these things are playing into a very, I would say, a very tense and delicate situation that needs to be resolved. Yeah.
Seema, 30 seconds, just your thought on watching developments and the possibility of conflict.
Well, I think the concern is that these tensions are between two nuclear-armed countries. Mm. And that's what's the concern, and which is why the UN has also intervened to say, please, you have to try and lower the tensions. But I think the concern in India is that this attack hit 26 civilians. They were tourists who were enjoying the beauty of Kashmir. And this is what happened. Normally in the past, when there have been attacks, perhaps they were between security forces and the militants. This time round, civilians were attacked. And I think that is also the expression of the frustration that's being felt in India. Pakistan, for its part, of course, say, well, perhaps the Indian authorities should be protecting its citizens better. But it's a tit for tat always. And the concern, of course, is they are nuclear armed.
Seema, thank you. A quick word tonight on the situation for a French teacher and her partner being held in Iran now for almost 3 years. Cécile Collet and her partner Jacques Paris were detained in May 2022, accused of seeking to stir up protests and spying, which they deny. There is growing concern over their health, and France has repeatedly lobbied for their release. Human rights groups saying tourists and dual nationals are often held for leverage in diplomatic negotiations. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you to my esteemed panellists, Victor Mallet, senior editor at the Financial Times. Also to Elisabeth Pinault, Paris correspondent at Reuters. And we've been joined from Rome by Seema Gupta, France 24's Italy correspondent. And thank you too from Ukraine for Svetlana Morinet, Ukrainian journalist, staff writer too at The Spectator. Thank you all. Thank you for watching. We wish you 1,000 times good night. In a week, the world celebrated the 461st birthday of Shakespeare. But we will leave the last word to the Pope. There is always light. We'll see you in 7 days for the world next week.
En la familia discutimos.
Families, we quarrel.
En la familia a veces vuelan los platos.
And sometimes plates can fly.
Porque Dios es bueno. No voy a hablar de la suegra.
I won't speak about mother-in-laws.
Pero en las familias siempre, siempre hay cruz. Siempre.
But in families, there is always light.